This is East End Inc. A group of writers and fans of Emily Dickinson gathered at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor in December of 2019 to celebrate Dickinson's work on the anniversary of her birth on December 10, 1830 in Amherst, Massachusetts. The readers included poet teacher Julie Sheehan, Sandra Dunn, and Sigrid Meinel, along with Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Soka of Canio's Books. We begin with Julie Sheehan's analysis of some of Dickinson's work.
I mean, I guess my question about her is, like, what does she really think? What does she think about religion? How does she navigate this spiritual condition, right? And can we tell that from her poems? She's perfectly positioned in that 19th century upsweep of religious fervor, the, you know, second great awakening. She's in New England. She's in Amherst, Massachusetts, where she's surrounded by, you know, Calvinist preachers and, you know, this sort of revival of religious fervor. So biographically speaking, she's perfectly positioned to be a messenger of religiosity, right? But we also know from her biography that one day she stopped going to church and she never went back, right? So this would have been after the time when, so Congregationalist, you know, Calvinist, her parish that she attended was a Congregationalist parish, and you would have, as you do in most Christian religion, well, all Christian religions, baptism as a baby. So, you know, water poured over you, you are named or marked as Christ's own. So that's the key piece of text of why, you know, this ritual happens. But it sort of doesn't count because you're a baby and you don't get to choose, you know, whether or not this happens to you. So when you reach an age of reason, sometime in your teens, you should do this again voluntarily and, you know, have an act of confirmation, some kind of public commitment to your own Christianity. And that seems to have been the sort of stopping point for Emily Dickinson, right? So this is sort of the Christian version of a bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, right? But she never did this. And so we can see in the poem 508, which starts with the line, "I'm seated, I've stopped being theirs." We can see this moment of decision about whether or not to make that kind of commitment to a religious practice. "I'm seated. I've stopped being theirs. The name they dropped upon my face with water in the country church is finished using now. And they can put it with my dolls, my childhood, and the string of spools. I've finished threading, too." So just in that little chunk, the speaker's giving us the condition of the present moment, which is seated. And that's an interesting word to use because it suggests that the church is a nation state. They can say, oh, well, we'll let, you know, Maine go or California. We'll cede that territory. We'll let Emily Dickinson go and cede it. So it's this political term having to do with nation states. And then the line, "I've stopped being theirs," you know, also doubles down on possession and the lack of being possessed, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the current state, the now. I am right now seated. So it's a state of maybe independence. We don't know what happens to this territory. We just know it's no longer part of the church state, right? So it's a point of independence. The poem is looking back then on a past condition of having been baptized. And that condition is finished. It's no more. it's childish, and it takes a certain amount of nerve to just be like, you know, put my baptism certificate along with the wooden spools that I used to, you know, string on a shoelace for fun. And it's without choice, as we find in the very next line, right? Baptized before, without the choice, but this time consciously of grace, unto supremest name called to my full. And if we stop right there and think about where this poem is headed, where the moment, this is the moment where the speaker should say, I, in my majority, accept Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. This is the moment where the act of confirmation ought to happen. Does it happen? It does not happen, right? A good Protestant should you know, burst into confirmation. But instead, the poem, I think, gets really hard to understand. Mm. It goes to the crescent dropped, which, like, what is this crescent? Why is it dropping? That sounds bad, I think. Not sure. Existence's whole arc filled up with one small diadem. And if we stop right there, we're seeing this is a moment of decision. This is the decision. But it's expressed in this, like, kind of weird architectural language, right? So I don't know what the crescent is, but it's the same shape as an arc, existence's arc. And it's the same shape as the diadem, the crown that fits on one head, right? So it could be maybe the bowl you pour the water from, the ladle, or it's a pitcher usually, but whatever. And that image, though, that lands on the crown, on the diadem, that becomes the language of the rest of the poem. It starts to get really royal. So we've gone from the church as this nation state that cedes territory to this kingdom with a monarch, right? My second rank, that's now, my stature now, too small the first, crowned now, crowing on my father's breast, a half unconscious queen. So that sounds like a baby-sized queen to me, right? Like the queen is a newborn, you know, being held, but then only for those, that little moment, right? But this time, adequate, erect. So no, not a baby held or clasped on my father's breast and not half unconscious, but adequate, erect, standing on my own feet, adult, right? With will to choose or to reject. And I choose just a crown. Wow. Like the combination of audacity and and modesty or whatever that is. But it's a moment of self-baptism and self ordination and self-coronation, right, into some powerful role, which could be the role of the poet, whatever, the queen of something, the queen of language, the queen that wields some kind of power that's outside of the church's territory. So definitely a spiritual power, but not a churchly power. So back in Amherst, everyone around her seemed kind of okay that she was unchurched in this way. And maybe she was established enough as eccentric that everyone was like, well, that's Emily. Whatever the reason, it was definitely not lack of knowledge, because she was very schooled in Christian ritual. She was schooled in hymnody. And women at that period were writing hymns. It was one of the few sort of ways to be a professional writer as a woman. So we have, of course, in 1862, Julie Ward Howe writing Battle Hymn of the Republic. But she wasn't the only one. There were like famous women hymn writers at the time. She was extremely knowledgeable about the Bible. It would be the King James Version that she would have used. Calvinists thought she loved sermons. She wrote about them in letters. If someone was interesting in a sermon, that was a way to participate in intelligentsia. You know, that was the intelligentsia. You know, the life of the mind came through talks that that ministers gave on the text from the Bible. And she spent a year at Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, whatever that was. She did it for a year and that was like enough. So sometime around then is when like everyone was like, okay, she doesn't go to church. So by her mid-20s, she was no longer practicing. She definitely persisted in writing about questions central to religion, and two of them that I think are especially key to her work. What does mortality mean? And why do we have both a bodily material self and an ethereal breath, spirit, soul self? Why? So I think that's just one of her big questions. Less interesting to her are questions of right and wrong, which we normally associate with religion. So she was not into a poem as moral instruction. There's no moral instruction, even though that was a very common, you know, go back to Anne Bradstreet and some, you know, women writing poetry. Oftentimes it was the vehicle for moral instruction of their children or, you know, of the community. Not for her. And she does not recommend corrective actions. She does not tell us what to do, how to practice. She asks the questions about the condition without the answers of practice. And it's very interesting to think her explosive writing years, when all the poems were pouring out of her at such a furious pace, match up exactly with the Civil War, 1861 to 1865, with 1862 being the real, which is when the poem we just looked at was probably written. Boom, every day, a new poem, multiple poems in a single day. So the Civil War was certainly fought over questions of autonomy and control and independence. And, you know, you go back to that line, I'm seated, I'm no longer theirs, and think of that in terms of the Civil War. And yet she stays weirdly distant from the prescriptive nature of war, from the action of it. All right, so there's a second poem let's look at that's right around that same time, number 501. It's also in this little book. This world is not conclusion. So we go from origin, baptism, birth, beginnings. Let's think about the other end of the equation, right? This world is not conclusion. That's starting off asserting, it would seem, some kind of afterlife, presenting us with some sort of beyondness that we get into more in the second line. A species stands beyond our this world, our here and our now. There's a whole group of other creatures or people, right? This world is not conclusion. A species stands beyond invisible as music, but positive as sound. So far we're very comfortably in a Christian worldview. Beyond our here and now and after it, there's this other world. It's peopled by a species. We can't see it, but it's there, just like music we can't see, but we know it's there. But not wherever that is not, it's not enough to still the tooth. So this question of the afterlife is gnawing at the end, where at the beginning it was so confidently stated. this world is not conclusion, and then the tooth that nibbles at the soul. So this, to me, is a central feature of Dickinson's poetry, revolving around and obsessing over the fact that we can conceptualize stuff. We can conceptualize faith, afterlife, perfection, truth, these ideas, but we can never experience them in the tangible world. Imagination and experience are at odds, and poems contain this tension because they're things and their meanings of what, you know, they're black scribbles on. She wrote poems on her lamp. She wrote poems on her desk. She wrote poems on not just paper. And when she used paper, it was the back of, you know, she would write on your scarf, and then she would write on some, like, the back of a recipe and envelopes and scraps. And so, but any surface was potentially the place where a poem would carve out meaning, which goes into this intangible world. So the poem's both rooted in the physical world and immaterial and mysterious in that way.
This is East End Dink. We heard poet and teacher Julie Sheehan with an analysis of some of the work of Emily Dickinson. We continue with Sandra Dunn reading from Emily Dickinson's work.
Awake, ye muses nine, sing me a strain divine, unwind the solemn twine, and tie my valentine. Oh, the earth was made for lovers, for damsel and hopeless swain, for sighing and gentle whispering, and unity made of twain. All things do go according in earth or sea or air. God hath made nothing single but thee in his world so fair. The bride and then the bridegroom, the two and then the one, Adam and Eve, his consort, the moon, and then the sun. The life doth prove the precept, who obey shall happy be, who will not serve the sovereign, be hanged on fatal tree. The high do seek the lowly, the great do seek the small, none cannot find who seeketh on this terrestrial ball. The bee doth court the flower his suit receives, and they make merry wedding, whose guests are hundred leaves. The wind doth woo the branches, they are one, and the father fond demandeth the maiden for his son. The storm doth walk the seashore, humming a mournful tune, the wave with eye so pensive, looketh to see the moon. Their spirits meet together, they make them solemn vows. No more he singeth mournful, her sadness she doth lose. The worm doth woo the mortal, death claims a living bride. Night unto day is married, morn unto eventide. Earth is a merry damsel, and heaven a knight so true, and earth is quite coquettish, and beseemeth in vain to sue. Now to the application, to the reading of the roll, to bringing thee to justice, and marshalling thy soul. Thou art a human solo, a being cold and lone. Wilt have no kind compassion, thou reap'st what thou hast sown. Hast never silent hours, and minutes all too long, and a deal of sad reflection and wailing instead of song? There's Sarah and Eliza and Emmeline so fair, and Harriet and Susan, and she with curling hair. Thine eyes are sadly blinded, but yet thou mayest see six true and comely maidens sitting upon the tree. Approach that tree with caution, then up it boldly climb, and seize the one thou lovest, nor care for space or time. Then bear her to the greenwood, and build for her a bower, and give her what she asketh, jewel or bird or flower, and bring the fife and trumpet and beat upon the drum, and bid the world good morrow and go to glory home. I taste a liquor never brewed from tankards scooped in pearl. Not all the Frankfurt berries yield such an alcohol. Inebriate of ye air I am I, and debauchee of dew, reeling through endless summer days from inns of molten blue, when landlords turn the drunken bee out of the foxglove's door. When butterflies renounce their drams, I shall but drink the more. Till seraphs swing their snowy hats and saints to windows run to see the little tippler from Manzanilla come.
Love me, you are sure. I shall not fear mistake. I shall not cheated wake some grinning morn to find the sunrise left and orchards unbereft and Dolly gone. I need not start, you're sure, that night will never be, when frightened, home to thee I run, to find the windows dark, and no more Dolly, Mark, quite none. Be sure you're sure, you know, I'll bear it better now, if you'll just tell me so, than when a little dull balm grown over this pain of mine, you sting again.
The doomed regard the sunrise with different delight, because when it burns abroad, they doubt to witness it. The man to die tomorrow harks for the meadow bird, because its music stirs the axe that clamors for his head. Joyful to whom the sunrise precedes enamored day, joyful for whom the meadow bird has aught but elegy.
After great pain, a formal feeling comes. The nerves sit ceremonious like tombs. The stiff heart questions, was it he that bore, and yesterday, or centuries before? The feet mechanical go round, of ground, or air, or aught. A wooden way, regardless grown, a quartz contentment, like a stone. This is the hour of lead, remembered, if outlived, as freezing persons recollect the snow, first chill, then stupor, then the letting go.
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog. To tell your name the livelong June to an admiring bog.
I can wade grief, hold pools of it. I'm used to that. But the least push of joy breaks up my feet, and I tip drunken. Let no pebble smile, 'twas the new liquor, that was all. Power is only pain, stranded through discipline, till weights will hang. Give balm to giants, and they'll wilt like men. Give Himalaya, they'll carry him.
Water is taught by thirst, land by the oceans past, transport by throw, peace by its battles told, love by memorial mold, birds by the snow. Wild nights, were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury. Futile the winds to a heart and port, done with the compass, done with the chart. Growing in Eden, ah, the sea, might I but moor tonight in thee. The difference between despair and fear is like the one between the instant of a wreck and when the wreck has been. The mind is smooth, no motion, contented as the eye upon the forehead of a bust that knows it cannot see.
I'm wife. I've finished that other state. I'm czar. I'm woman now. It's safer so. How odd the girl's life looks behind this soft eclipse. I think that earth feels so to folks in heaven now. This being comfort, then, that other kind was pain. But why compare? I'm wife. Stop there. I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading, till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again, then space began to toll. As all the heavens were a bell and being but an ear, an eye and silence, some strange race wrecked, solitary, here. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down, and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing then.
This is East End Dink. We heard a portion of a reading of the work of Emily Dickinson recorded in December 2019 at Catio's book Sag Harbor. The readers included poet teacher Julie Sheehan of Stony Brook University, Southampton, Sandra Dunn, Sigrid Meinel, and Marianne Callendrill and Catherine Soka of Catio's books. A more complete version of the reading is available online at eastendinc.blogspot.com. The nonprofit Canio's Cultural Cafe at 290 Main Street in Sag Harbor has scheduled the following free literary events, subject to change because of the current health crisis, of course. On Saturday, April 4th at 5 p.m., poet activist Kathy Engel reads from her new collection, The Lost Brother Alphabet. And on Saturday, April 25th at 5 p.m., a celebration of Earth Day. Author, poet, farmer Scott Chasky reads from his work, surveying 30 years of community-supported organic farming and more. In May, a series of events will celebrate the life and work of Toni Morrison. An updated schedule is available online at caniosbooks.com. East End Inc. is heard on the fourth and occasional fifth Wednesday of each month. Programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. And podcasts are available at soundcloud.com. Search for East End Inc. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Canio's Marianne Callendrill and Catherine Soper.